Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, Soundcheck's Year to Remember series concludes today with a look at 1959 and pivotal albums released by Miles Davis, Ornette Coleman, and other giants of jazz. That's today at 2 and 10 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. Walt Whitman pinned us all as walking contradictions when he said, "I am large, contain multitudes." But how's this for multitudes? Jim Gilliam grew up the son of two computer geeks across the street from the church at the center of Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority movement in Virginia. He went on to attend Falwell's Liberty University, where he set up their first webpage and even hooked up Falwell's first computer. In college, Gilliam was diagnosed with cancer. Chemo followed, then bone marrow transplants, then a double lung transplant. Through this ordeal, evangelism gave way to a faith in technology, a connectivity on the Internet that became, in a way, Jim Gilliam's new religion. It's that story that has much of the wired world buzzing this week. Jim Gilliam gave a talk at the Personal Democracy Forum on Tuesday afternoon here in New York. That's where we first heard of him. Since then, his talk, "The Internet is My Religion," has gone viral, and Jim Gilliam joins us now not to talk about that idea or to talk about that idea and his current work as a developer of online political tools. Jim Gilliam, so nice of you to do this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And you gave your talk at PDF, the Personal Democracy Forum, which is a conference for people who work on the intersection of technology and politics. But talk now to a general audience and do this. Convince the skeptics in our audience that connections online can be as meaningful as connections in the physical world.
Well, the thing for me very early on in my life was that, you know, the physical world, you know, it was all about church, and we had like our, you know, it was a mega church, and we had, you know, baseball teams, right, for all the kids, and my dad coached them and all that stuff. So there was a significant amount of community that developed around what was going on in church, and that's what really brought people together constantly. But then at the same time, I started to see like a whole different kind of community that was really interesting and very, very diverse that was happening online. It was really intoxicating and exciting because, you know, no one was, there were no biases because I was, you know, tall or geeky looking, or in particular that I was like very, very young. So I was interacting with people that were much older than me, and that was just, you know, I was judged on my brain, not discounted because of my age, right? And that was sort of really exciting to me.
Yeah, and in your talk you say that, you know, in terms of getting things from people we're not meeting face-to-face, that we owe our lives to people we will never meet, soldiers who keep us safe, researchers who find new medicines. So the Internet is just another example of that.
I really had a hard time processing, you know, the fact that, like, you know, going from this very fiercely independent worldview of, like, look, I can do anything. I don't need anybody else's help, right? I was sort of very, very clear about that. And then to the point where I, you know, not only did I get sick, and not only did I need all kinds of people to sort of just help me, I had nurses and doctors and my family and their friends and all kinds of people, but then it got so intense to the point where, like, I needed, like, physically other parts of people's bodies, right, to stay alive. And, you know, so there's this, you know, big joke on me, it kind of felt like, where it's like, wow, okay, so, you know, you think you're independent? Yeah, well, watch out.
Right. And listeners, I wonder if you're relating to this. Jim Gilliam says the connection he finds online is the same or different, but also of extremely high quality as the connection he found in religion. Do you agree? What kinds of connections do you find online, and what do they mean to you? Give us a call with maybe some of your most meaningful examples of virtual human connectivity. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show online. Can you tell the story, Jim, of how your Internet friends shamed UCLA into operating on you?
First of all, I love the people at UCLA. They literally saved my life. So, but it was really hard kind of getting there. So there were sort of two factors that were playing against me in getting on the lung transplant. I had cancer before, so there was a high probability that it could come back if they had to suppress my immune system so that I would not reject the lungs. And then two, the surgery itself was particularly difficult because of the scarring and the way that it occurred in my lungs. I was really upset, so I just blogged about it, right, just trying to vent. And, you know, someone who has been following the story, like one of the volunteers at Brave New Films, you know, she wrote this email, just the regular UCLA email address, you know, and said, you know, hey, you know, we know Jim, he's worth saving, right? And then so my sister called in and other folks emailed in, and they're like, look, you know, your stats are high, that's great, but it's because you're doing easy surgeries. And this got forwarded, apparently, to the surgeon that runs the transplant program at UCLA. And my case had been rejected before it had even gotten to him, right? So he sees it, he's like, I'm not afraid of any surgeries. You know? And he brought me in, and it was still a struggle after that to get past the transplant board and the insurance companies, and there were many, many tests that took months to sort of get through. But
they challenged his pride, his macho.
Lung transplant surgeons, you know, have many, many great qualities, like I said in the talk. Humility is certainly not one of them. And I'm very grateful for that, too, because he truly did save my life. Yeah.
So many people think of technology and religion as somehow incompatible. I mean, I don't think that's true. I think a lot of churches and other religious organizations, from Osama bin Laden to whatever, are using technology. But when you were at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University working to set up, I guess, the first computer lab there, was it ever seen as a conflict? Was it ever seen as a threat to their values?
Absolutely it was, yeah. I mean, we had to fight really hard. My colleague in the computer lab, we had to convince the administration that we should provide, you know, uncensored access to the internet to all the students, and basically trust the students to not violate what was called the Liberty Way, which was sort of the rules and guidelines by which the community was run. And it's a Christian university, there are pretty strict rules. But the big thing became pornography, right? It was sort of very much against the rules to view porn, and obviously that's kind of, there's a lot of it on the internet. But we provided for free and open access, and then we would actually, you know, search the logs every once in a while and catch people watching porn.
Right. But restricting access to the internet because somebody might watch porn is like telling them they can't walk down the street past a newsstand.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that was, we felt very, very strongly as the technology folks, like, you know, that it was important to trust people and to provide free access, because, like, if we were censoring based upon keywords and things like that, it was going to block all kinds of stuff that was important, too.
Do you think it
just go against, like, what we believed, you know?
Do you think it's possible to become more wired and have that lead you to be more religious?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I view the internet as a very sacred place, right? It's where we can all come together, regardless of race, color, creed, you know, the whole bit, and interact with each other in ways that were never before possible. And, you know, I think that as a culture, if we begin to look at it that way, that it will have a transformative effect on the policy and how we think about sort of living our lives and sort of what it is that's important for us to do. You know, the internet really wants us to become creators. It wants us to contribute. It wants us, you know, all these, you know, we sort of make fun of it sometimes with all the cat videos, but really it's people, you know, expressing themselves, right? And there's so many amazing things that happen online, and we, you know, from Wikipedia to, you know, the blogs everyone sets up, and as the production costs come down, where we can make more and more things and contribute to what's great about the internet, that's going to be what really connects us all and really makes something wonderful.
By the way, I think I misspoke earlier when I said that you grew up and attended Liberty University, Falwell's University in Virginia. That's, I think, the center of it. But you were at one in California, correct?
I grew up in California, and I did actually go to Liberty University later. But
oh, you did?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Well, listeners, reactions to Jim Gilliam and his story about technology and religion and his personal health, an inspiring story that's really making the rounds online now after he originally delivered this talk at the Personal Democracy Forum here in New York earlier this week. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And have you ever had any experience like this? What kinds of connections do you find online that are as meaningful as somebody's religion might be to them? Has the internet ever made you more religious or less religious? 212-433-9692 or post online to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Andrew in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello. Andrew, you there? All right, let's see. How about if I do this? Right, let me get... Andrew, I think we have you now.
Okay, great. Thank you, Brian. What I want to say is just that, first, you know, you heard the expression, do not believe everything that you read on the internet unless you can double-check it or triple-check it. And in my own personal experiences, I almost joined the Mormon religion until I did further research and was able to see what the original prophets of the Mormon religion really said and thought, and not what the present-day LDS church is spinning. I was able to go through the internet into something called the Mormon Journal of Discourses through the Mormon Research Institute, and from former Mormons, I was able to see that this is not really a belief system that I can join. So I was very, very grateful that through the internet I was able to research and go back, because the 1830s is not so far away, and I was able to uncover many original documents about what the Mormon prophets, the racism, the disingenuous documentation of the Book of Abraham and the Book of Mormon. So thank you very much, okay?
Thank you very much for telling us that story. And, you know, other people will disagree about how to view the Mormon Church, but there is a connection between Andrew and religion and finding information online. Bob in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Brian. I've had face-to-face audio recorded interviews with World War II combat veterans, and in a number of cases after they have died, I have been able to contact their sons and or daughters through email, because that's very unobtrusive as opposed to a phone call, and simply indicated that if they would be interested, I have a copy of the interview. I can send them a written copy and or the audio. I have found a number of situations where the sons and daughters had such a bad relationship with their father because he never shared with them, and then to read the transcript and to get some insight into what he went through at the age of 20 or 21, and then usually after a period of time, follow that up with the actual audio, has in some cases actually changed their life with respect to how they now regard their father, who they didn't really get along with when he was alive.
That's fascinating, and I know that the World War II generation is obviously very old right now, and I'm sure there are a lot of families right at this moment having older relatives bring out memories that they suppressed or just didn't want to talk about for many years. And as people start to approach the end of their lives, maybe they want to talk about them more, and maybe people want to hear about them more. That this happened among some people I know just recently. You think that's happening a lot, Bob?
Oh, there's no doubt the men will talk about it more because they have much more free time to think about it. They sort of regress almost going back in time. They can recall what happened in 1944,
yeah,
like it happened yesterday. And now I think the older children, many of whom are in their 50s, mid-50s or older, are begging for that information. But in many cases for them, it's too late. Their father's already passed.
So what is it that you said that people could get a copy of?
Well, I've interviewed a number of World War II veterans. Everyone has been face-to-face with a tape recorder. The average interview is about an hour and a half to 2 hours. So what I will do is I will contact the individual. I will say, you don't know me. I interviewed your dad. If you're interested, please let me know. I have some information that might be of interest. Many don't respond, but then some will respond. At that point, I will give them a summary of the transcript. It's a written summary. If after reading that they want more gruesome, in some cases, detail, I give them the full transcript. And after that, if they want to hear their father's name, words, I will send them a copy of the tape.
That is really interesting. Bob, hang on. We're going to get your information off the air if you want to give it to us. I don't want to just put your email address or something on the air, but if you want people to get in touch, we'll help you figure out a way to do it. Thank you very much for calling. Boy, that's a heck of a story, Jim, huh?
Absolutely. And what is one thing that's really core to the Christian faith in particular is the idea of the testimony. And that's what I was doing with the speech. I was testifying as to how, you know, the internet changed my life, how people connected changed my life, right? And there are, I just know there are so many stories like the one we just heard that are exactly that. And so that's one of the things that we want to do with the website that we just set up, internetismyreligion.com, is that we're going to have a place there for people to testify of how the internet has changed their lives. And I just, it's staggering and it's inspiring. And, you know, I hope that I kind of put it out there and said, you know, maybe we can start to tell these stories. It would be great.
Selma in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Jim Gilliam. Hi.
Oh, hi there. I just want to say that having been raised, you know, religiously, I'm at this point in my life, I'm a sort of agnostic about religion. But I think the truly religious person, which there are not, which there are few, very few, you know, is concerned about his fellow man. You know, what they have to do is, but apparently the religious people, Christians, a lot of them don't read the Bible, and at least haven't read Christ, Jesus Christ, the words of Jesus Christ, you know, in the New Testament and even in the Old Testament. And I also want to say there's some aspects of technology that are worthwhile and are very useful. And science too, and some, you know, aspect of science are also. But I don't think there's any conflict between a reasonable religion like a religion and science. There's some aspects of both that conflict with each other, but that's about it.
Selma, thank you, and that's a great question, Jim, because we presented you as someone who started out around Jerry Falwell's Liberty University and wound up kind of changing to, you know, a religion of human connectedness through the internet. Are they incompatible? Are you still a Christian?
I'm not a Christian. I think that I think what she's describing at the core is sort of the great failings, right, of the past religions, right? They are based around people saying, look, what's happening on this planet is bad, it stinks, but guess what? You know, we're either going to be raptured to heaven or you're going to die eventually and go to heaven, right? So it doesn't really matter. And I think that is what people are, they feel that that's just wrong. They're like, well, we need to take responsibility for our world, for making it a better place. And the internet kind of gives us, and the internet and just what it means, like being able to be all connected with each other, gives us the opportunity, right, to sort of create that own world ourselves. We're like, each of us are creators, but then together we are the creator, right? And that, that's what I feel like all religions that we've had before have sort of really failed us on.
Although, isn't the idea of hell, for example, or the idea of what you're going to be reincarnated as in Hinduism, or I could probably think of a dozen other examples from other religions, intended not actually to focus you on the afterlife and disconnect you from other human beings today, but serve as motivators, whether it's the fear of hell or, you know, the incentive is coming back as a higher being or whatever it is, actually intended to connect you and make you a more moral person in this life?
Absolutely, yeah, and the emails that I'm getting and stuff like that are from people of all walks of traditional faith, right? And what's been sort of mind-blowing to me has been how people are connecting with it across all religious boundaries, right? And I believe it's because of what you just articulated, right? It's because, mm-hmm. you know, there is sort of this core understanding that at the end of the day, what matters is that all of us are connected.
Well, we will leave it there with Jim Gilliam. Maybe a good last word. Margaret on our comments page writes a bit of historical context, I guess. She says, what was the first major work that Gutenberg printed with his new technology, the printing press? The Bible. So maybe it's all tied together. I don't know. Where can people see your talk or read anything else you may have written?
The internet is myreligion.com is where the video is, and you can send it to your friends, and more importantly, start telling your own story of how the internet changed your life, because that's what's most powerful.
And we also have a link to that right on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Jim Gilliam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, we will finish up in just a minute with maybe an unusual kind of eulogy for the co-creator of Mad Libs, who was also a scriptwriter for The Honeymooners, by the way, who died. Yes, you will help us write this eulogy for the co-creator of Mad Libs. Stay with us.